also have to apply for asylum in the country where the NGO-run ship is flagged in. Italy's Interior Minister Matteo Piantedosi has said the new provisions aim to prevent organized campaigns to transport asylum seekers departing from Libya and other countries to Italy.
We asked if the migrant issue would be the main focus of the next year's opening council of the EU ministers' meeting. The EU needs a serious and constructive approach on the matter in order to draw a clear distinction between asylum seekers and irregular migrants.
According to the Italian government, saving lives at sea has contributed to increasing migration, and while some NGO ships genuinely carry out rescues, others engage, quote, in systematic searches for people in cahoots with migrant traffickers. Humanitarian groups have warned that the government's measures will stop them from saving lives.
Bisogna informare.
People departing from Libya and other countries for Italy must be immediately informed by the media about the risks they would face by crossing the Mediterranean Sea, so that they can reconsider their decision. The best case scenario for them is to end up in a detention center in Libya. It's hell for people in there.
Over 90,000 people have arrived at Italy's ports this year. Rome has been stopping many NGO-run ships from docking in the country, on one occasion sparking a diplomatic rift with France after an NGO-run vessel flying the French flag was denied entry. Italy's policies on the migrant issue have been strongly condemned over the years. In 2017, the Italian government signed an EU-sponsored agreement with the Libyan government. The deal authorizes Italy and the EU to help the Libyan Coast Guard enhance its maritime surveillance capacity by providing financial support and technical assets. In practical terms, under the deal, every asylum seeker intercepted at sea ends up in a Libyan detention center where torture, sexual violence and abuse are practiced. That deal today is still in place. Max Civilli, Rome.
Brazil is less than a week away from Lula da Silva's return to the presidency, and preparations are underway for a massive festival in Brasilia, which will be held alongside the official events. Tens of thousands of members of social movements and Lula supporters from around the country are preparing to travel to the capital, many of whom will be camping out to celebrate the new government at the Festival of the Future, for which dozens of Brazilian artists have confirmed their performances. There is both a sense of excitement and tension as protests against the incoming government by supporters of outgoing Jair Bolsonaro are expected. Despite multiple thwarted plots, called terror plots by the incoming government, people are determined to make their way to Brasilia.
I'm going to Brasilia from Sao Paulo to be there for the inauguration of our president Lula, who will be there, which is very satisfying and makes me proud. And I'm also looking forward to participating in the celebrations and festivities of the social movement.
I'm heading to the inauguration of our president Lula. I want to be with him at the festivities, singing and supporting him, because there are so many good things to happen in our country.
The presidential transition is advancing, and President-elect Lula has been making known some of his ministerial appointments. Among the most notable are singer, songwriter, and actress Margareth Menezes, who will take on the role of Minister of Culture, and lawyer and writer Silvio Almeida, who serve as Minister of Human Rights. Lula's former environmental minister, Marina Silva, will take another turn heading the ministry. Sources close to Jair Bolsonaro say that he will not be handing off the presidential sash to Lula da Silva and will be taking an extended holiday at Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort in the United States. Camila Escalante, Sao Paulo.
Lebanon's economic meltdown is about to enter its fourth year with additional afflictions in its trail. Although the country could finally hold the much-awaited parliamentary elections, it entered the trap of a presidential election stalemate.
With the mindset and the mentality of many of the Lebanese politicians, I think it's a very difficult process. You mentioned the Lebanese forces. It's known the Lebanese forces have this blind hatred and ideological demonization of other parties, first and foremost Hezbollah. This facilitates the intervention of foreign parties like Saudi Arabia, who are said to put a veto on certain presidential candidates.
The year 2022 was not all towards a downfall for Lebanon. The year marked the finalization of a maritime border deal signed by Lebanon and Israel after more than a decade of on-off indirect talks. Hezbollah Secretary General stressed in a brief statement that the deal is a victory for Lebanon's government, people, and resistance. He also declared the end of Hezbollah's exceptional mobilization over the maritime dispute, saying the resistance movement had accomplished its mission regarding the issue.
What happened in Nakara is not normalization with Israel. This deal is not an international treaty and is not a recognition of Israel. Israel itself has admitted it received no security guarantees.
Analysts believe Hezbollah made the right calculations in this move.
What stood out for me was the pragmatism exercised by Hezbollah in this particular agreement. It was very pragmatic in its approach, focusing, I think, first and foremost on Lebanon's economic interests, particularly with the dire economic situation. I think it was also a smart game played by Hezbollah, because I think that they believed deep down there was a conviction by the leadership that Biden couldn't afford another war and would prevent Israel from launching a war, even if Israel had a wish.
The deal is also seen as one of the major achievements of former President Michel Aoun, who stepped down in November without a successor. Now, while Lebanese lawmakers have so far failed to elect a new president, the caretaker cabinet remains in place since the parliamentary vote last spring, showing no sign of efforts to implement economic reforms.
As Lebanon ends the year 2022 without a president, observers are skeptical that any achievement concerning this file can be achieved soon. However, many believe that prospects for gas production and export are promising in the new year. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Brits are still reeling from the impact of 2022. It's hard to recall a political year that's seen the country lurch from one crisis to the next, all bookended, it seems, by the saga of which particular Conservative Prime Minister was in charge. Boris Johnson had managed to cling on to power despite mounting evidence presented that his position had become untenable. His missteps during lockdown, dubbed Partygate, a faltering economy exacerbated by the outbreak of conflict in Ukraine, made his departure an inevitability. The race to replace him was brutal, exposing the deep divisions within the Conservatives. Party members chose Liz Truss over Sunak before, but that was only the beginning of the saga. Analyst Chris Bambury was following events closely and reflects on that period of chaos.
We had this strange interim where Liz Truss beat Sunak, clearly showing that a majority of the Conservative Party membership were not going to vote for Sunak for reasons which I think are fairly obvious, which I never really talked about. Truss was a disaster. And then we ended up with Sunak being shoehorned into the Prime Ministership with no actual election.
I am resigning as leader of the Conservative Party.
Ah, the blink and you'll miss it Truss era. 7 weeks of chaos which saw the pound take a hit and the markets recoil at the sheer ineptitude on political display. There was a sense that the UK's political landscape had now become a running joke.
The chaos of the Liz Truss premiership, you know, was just awesome. I don't think we've ever seen anything like that in British politics. British politics is supposed to be about stability. It prides itself in selling itself, Britain, as a brand to the rest of the world that has been politically stable. This was like Italian politics, you know, and prime ministers just coming and going. This did not give a vision of Britain as a stable political entity.
Not content with topsy-turvy politics, the UK's longest-serving monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, passed away aged 96, leaving the UK contemplating its colonial legacy. With King Charles III with Camilla, Queen Consort, by his side, it was a new era, but one filled with old uncertainties.
I shall strive to follow the inspiring example I have been set in upholding constitutional government and to seek the peace, harmony, and prosperity of the peoples of these islands.
Despite the passing of the baton, the impact of Brexit, the stalemate in the north of Ireland, with the cost of living crisis biting, Prime Minister's in-tray was bulging. 2022 is also the year Britain saw a re-emergence of strike action across a multitude of sectors.
We have been reasonable, but it is impossible to find a negotiated settlement when the dead hand of the government is presiding over and blocking a resolution in these talks.
We are seeing the recovery of industrial unrest, workers taking trade union action, and finding that when they go on strike, they are popular, that people sympathise with them, sections of the working class and indeed the middle class. And I think that spells trouble ahead. These strikes, we haven't seen anything like this in Britain really since the days of Margaret Thatcher. This is new, and I think people are learning new habits, new skills of taking industrial disputes. And I think potentially this is a bit of a game changer down the road.
Rishi Sunak and the rest of his Conservative government will be desperately hoping that there is not a repeat of the past tumultuous year. A 12-month period that's seen record number of Brits slide into poverty. But analysts are warning that desperate changes need to happen because so far it seems the Tories are heavy on excuses and light on solutions. On the cusp of a new year, there are many challenges awaiting the average British family. Whoever is in charge in Downing Street, it's the most vulnerable who continue to pay the heaviest price. Without firm solutions from the political class, it seems the upcoming period might hold still more pain for those who can ill afford it. Amina Taylor, London.
Japan has slowly developed the scope and scale of its military forces since its defeat in World War II, despite its pacifist constitution. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Friday announced a major shift in its post-war self-defense principle.
When considering strengthening our defense capabilities this time, we will assume various situations and consider whether the current capabilities of self-defense forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counter-strike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counterattack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China. Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that more than $300 billion is earmarked to be spent in America's military-industrial complex. Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual military spending to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Thousands turned out on Thursday to commemorate the 13th anniversary of the 2009 nationwide rallies that put an end to the post-election unrest back then and also renewed their allegiance to the Islamic establishment.
I want to tell the whole world that even if all our enemies unite to defeat us, we will all defend our leader and our country.
I have two messages, one for our enemies and one for our people. To the enemies, I say, you cannot promote an anti-hijab culture in Iran. And to our people, I say, we should remain vigilant regarding the enemy's plots against the Islamic Republic.
The demonstrators also denounced any act of violence and sabotage by foreign-backed rioters against the Islamic Republic.
Anyone who believes in God and holds onto that belief will eventually be rewarded by God. This verse of the Holy Quran applies to the situation we're in today, so it's very important to show our full support for the leader.
According to a statement read at the end of the rallies, Iranians will not tolerate any acts of sabotage that would jeopardize the security and territorial integrity of the country.
I have been taking part in popular demonstrations because it's very important to keep the memory of our martyrs alive, all those who lost their lives so that we can live in a peaceful environment and an independent country.
We are here to pledge allegiance to the leader and to commemorate the rallies that put an end to the Farhan-backed riots 13 years ago. We are here to say that we will support Ayatollah Khamenei till the last drop of our blood.
The occasion, dubbed the Ninth of Day Epic, refers to the huge demonstrations held in Tehran and other cities across Iran on the ninth of the month of Day in the Persian calendar, which falls on December 30th, in support of the Islamic Republic. The rallies restored calm in the country and put an end to the post-election unrest, and therefore every year Iranians mark the occasion by taking part in nationwide demonstrations.
More than anything, this is a show of solidarity. People have turned out in the capital, Tehran, to show their support for leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, and also to show that they are as vigilant as they were back in 2009. Gisu Misha Ahmadi, Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Europe is facing a polycrisis these days, as experts say, between contradictory energy policies, the Ukraine war, and political disarray, the EU appears on a mission to harm itself. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East, I noted, better late than never. The old motto states, this should be the conclusion after reading the recent Economist's latest lead article on how Europe is frozen out. The magazine's concern is that the continent faces an enduring crisis of energy and geopolitics that will weaken it and threaten its global position, while the brutal economic squeeze will pose a test of Europe's resilience in 2023 and beyond. This perspective was already evident months ago, but only with an incoming freezing winter is it making its way to one of the flagships of Western mainstream media. The magazine also emphasizes the fear that the recasting of the global energy system, American economic populism, and geopolitical rifts threaten the long-run competitiveness of the European Union and non-members, including Britain, noting it is not just the continent's prosperity that is at risk, the health of the transatlantic alliance is too. Effectively, the high price that the U.S. charges Europe for its liquefied natural gas, LNG supplies, the Federal Reserve's policies on interest rates that are propping up the dollar, and the Biden administration's $369 billion package of green subsidies under the auspices of the Inflation Reduction Act have all heightened tensions between the two shores of the Atlantic. In such conditions, the European economy's competitiveness risks being compromised. The energy crisis remains Europe's top priority. The latest OECD Economic Outlook notes that the share of members' GDP spent on end-use energy is almost 18%, double what it was in 2020. The outlook also warns of a substantial risk that gas reserves in Europe will be smaller next winter than this one. According to the economist's own modeling, in a normal winter, a 10% rise in real energy prices is associated with a 0.6% increase in debt. Hence, the energy crunch this year could cause over 100,000 extra deaths of elderly people across Europe. Europe has been able to fill its gas stores for this coming winter almost to full capacity, but this target has been accomplished through an increase of more than 40% in imports of Russian LNG between January and October, compared with the same period last year. It is difficult to find a word better than tragi-economic to describe such a situation. This data exemplifies both EU foolishness and the dysfunction of its institutions. Geopolitical reasons have pushed Europe to diversify its energy supplies away from Russian gas in order to avoid relying on Russia. EU decision makers should now explain the logic behind giving up the cheapest supply option, pipe-delivered gas, to opt for the most expensive one, seaborne-delivered LNG from the same supplier. If the situation compels Europe to continue relying on Russian gas, why pick the most expensive option? The situation is so absurd that it leads people to ask, between the EU and Russia, who is really sanctioning whom? The EU's apparent drive towards self-harm could get a further boost from the price cap on Russian oil that Brussels is expected to adopt. The aim is to reduce Russia's revenues, but the situation could turn against Europe. No one really knows the possible impacts of such a measure on oil supply and price. The Biden administration has apparently lobbied the EU to relax its sanctions policy because further measures could completely disrupt oil markets and intensify the energy crunch. This marks a further tragicomic situation. The U.S., which with regards to some countries has claimed universal justification by applying its secondary sanctions against everybody, including EU members, is now pressuring the EU to avoid walking the same path over Ukraine. As a consequence, while transatlantic political relations have been reinvigorated by a strong cohesive position against Russia, economic relations could come under severe stress if the burden sharing on the Ukraine-Russia crisis economic cost continues to be unequal. This is a message that French President Emmanuel Macron delivered during his state visit to Washington. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has already conveyed a far more assertive message to Washington by visiting Beijing accompanied by top businessmen. Regardless of U.S. pressure and even contrary to the Brussels bureaucracy's own recommendations, Germany has no intention to decouple from China, seeming far more aware that the U.S. that, in words of its own chancellor, new centers of powers are emerging in a multipolar world, and we aim to establish and expand partnerships with all of them. In other words, Scholz's message to Biden is the following. If I have felt compelled to painfully sever my energy relationship with Russia due to the war in Ukraine, do not think for a moment that I will feel compelled to do the same for my trade relationship with China. U.S. economic policies and the energy crunch are damaging European economies to the point that even the economies recognizes that the continent is at risk of mass deindustrialization. Brussels decision makers are apparently unaware that they are running towards a cliff. The Biden administration might show more wisdom and common sense. After all, what advantage would the U.S. get in reinforcing the transatlantic bond if the price could ultimately be the economic destruction of the EU in the Eurasian continent? It is already evident that in the Russia-Ukraine conflict, Europe is the biggest external loser. But its anxieties do not end there. According to the European Central Bank's estimates, from now up until 2030, the EU should spend more than 5 trillion euros, 5 trillion euros, to move ahead with its green transition, diversify energy supplies, bridge the digital gap, and reach the NATO military expenditure target of 2% GDP, roughly equivalent to the cost of post-COVID EU recovery plan every year, until the end of the decade. It is difficult to imagine how Europe will be able to accomplish such a tremendous task in an era of polycrisis, described by former U.S. Treasury Secretary Larry Summers as the most complex, disparate, and cross-cutting set of challenges they have faced in four decades. It is even more difficult to imagine considering the current trio leading the EU. The presidents of the European Council and European Commission are apparently not on speaking terms after an April 2021 protocol arrangement placed the first on an armchair and the second on a sofa, while the third, the EU foreign policy chief, cultivate sophisticated visions of international politics, such as Europe is a garden and most of the rest of the world is a jungle. Indeed, Europe's drive for self-harm is running at full speed.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. The U.S. once again takes steps in line with its policies to spread Iranophobic propaganda. That's how the Iranian Foreign Ministry describes the anti-Iran provisions included in the U.S. National Defense Authorization Act for the year 2023. Tehran rejects the allegations against its regional activities and says it's Washington that destabilizes the West Asia region through its huge weapons sales to some regional countries and its unconditional support for the regime in Tel Aviv. We'll try to shed more light on the issue in tonight's Spotlight program with our guest, Professor at University of Tehran, Fuad Izadi, joining us from the Iranian capital. And we also have journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas, who's with us from the British capital, London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Professor Izadi in Tehran. Iran has denounced the hostile provisions of the U.S. National Defense Authorization Act, which is known as the NDAA, for the fiscal year of 2023, saying the decision attests to Washington's meddlesome policies against the Islamic Republic as in line with attempts to spread Iranophobia. Please elaborate on those comments for us and the reasons for such anti-Iran measures.
You know, NDAA is an annual event. It's the budget that the Pentagon uses. This year, you have a significant increase in the amount of money that the U.S. Congress has dedicated to war. Since this piece of legislation has to pass, we don't have any instances where this particular budget law has not passed. The anti-Iran forces in Washington generally get to put whatever they want against Iran in NDAA. So, for example, if you look at the previous NDAAs, a lot of sanctions that is imposed on Iran is actually passed as part of a previous NDAA legislations. And the reason the anti-Iran forces in Washington like to use NDAA is that they know that the U.S. president will sign it. They know that the law will pass, that the bill will pass, because you cannot leave the Pentagon without budget. So generally, when we look at NDAA, every year we get a feeling of how anti-Iran behaviors in Washington is going to increase in the year ahead. And so this is NDAA 2023, and it doesn't look good. The same old policies of anti-Iran rhetoric is very much present in this. It became law a few days ago. Biden signed it. A lot of accusations, a lot of general nonsense that you...
Sure. Said Mohsen Abbas in London, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said the anti-Iran provisions reflect the continuation of Washington's hostile, provocative, and meddlesome policies against Iran that are aimed at stoking Iranophobia and promoting a propaganda campaign against the Islamic Republic. Explain the U.S.'s constant enmity towards Iran, and do you see this as a continuation of the so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran?
It certainly is a continuation of that maximum pressure terrorism, I would describe it, because it covers not only the military bullying of the Islamic Republic of Iran by the Americans, but also the economic, psychological, and cultural bullying that goes along with the entire program that they have been rolling out ever since 1979, but it just progressively gets worse and worse. That's the reality. And the sad reality is the Americans have paid no regard for real stability being brought back to the Middle East. They, with this budget, they pay no regard to coming for any kind of peaceful rapprochement with the Islamic Republic of Iran and indeed any of the oppressed people across West Asia. There's no signs that they will be ending their love affair with the most brutal regime in that region, that's Israel. They show no signs of pulling up Israel for its kind of nuclear weapons violation, something which within this latest budget, it's clear that they're still gunning for Iran because they say that they've got nuclear capabilities. Well, yes, they have got nuclear capabilities for civil use of the nuclear technology, but they haven't committed, nor are they committed, nor do they want to be committed to a weapon. The Israelis, on the other hand, have a weapon, and the Americans sanction those weapons. They have over 400 nuclear weapons, many of them probably aimed at the Islamic Republic of Iran, but that doesn't concern the Americans because they're now on Benjamin Netanyahu's kind of bandwagon for saber-rattling and again probably calling for war. But at least if there's anything to be taken from this, it doesn't seem as though the Americans have got an appetite for an all-out war against Iran, because they've already, of course, engaged their budget for Ukraine to carry out that war against the Russians at the moment. Whether they'd like to open up another front would be quite suicidal, although you couldn't put anything past these American administrations, given that they're also stoking the cage of China by allocating a large amount of this budget to Taiwan and enhancing its kind of military capabilities, obviously another signal that is going against China. So America is in a kind of a wild, crazy state at the moment, more so than usual. It seems to think it can take on Russia, China, and Iran all at the same time. Well, within this budget, that seems to be the trajectory. And at the same time, they're continuing their callous policies in West Asia, trying to keep divide and rule going, keep the destruction and the wars and the plunder going.
Staying with you, Mr. Abbas, ultimately, who benefits from such anti-Iran measures?
Israel is the main beneficiary because Israel needs war. It needs Iran to be reined in, as they would put it, because Iran is the only power in that region which has the moral, the ethical, the military, and other means to be able to challenge Israel's violations of human rights, its violations of sovereignty of its neighbors, its violations of every kind in that region. It is the key, if you like, problem within West Asia, with its periphery doctrines, with its Odin Yinon plan for expansionism up to the Euphrates, with its support of ISIS, with its kind of pushing of America to constantly militarize the region, and with its kind of proxy control of Saudi Arabia and all those other puppet Arab nations, which are run by despots, again, siphoning off the wealth not only to the West, but also making sure that Israel has a buffer zone and is protected and can continue its callous, brutal pummeling of the Palestinian people.
Fouad Izadi, the U.S. constantly demonizes Iran's regional activities. Iran's foreign ministry has responded in an official statement just recently, saying that the U.S. has sealed the highest number of arms sales deals, signed many military defense cooperation agreements in the region, and its plentiful military bases jeopardize regional peace and stability. Now, by the looks of it, the U.S. is the real destabilizing factor in the region. How can an extra-regional player make such accusations about interregional affairs and instability?
You know, this is nothing new. We remember what the Western governments did during the Iran-Iraq war. They were saying that they're neutral, they're not going to support any sides. This was the rhetoric. In practice, they gave Saddam Hussein chemical weapons. They gave Saddam intelligence, pictures of Iranian troops. Americans did that. They gave him fighter jets. They gave him ammunition, other types of weapons, money, anything they had, they gave to Saddam. And they, at the same time that they were saying that they are not going to support any side. Even today, the American government is selling billions of dollars worth of weapon to the Saudi monarchy. During the Biden presidential race in 2020, he was saying that he opposes Trump's policy towards Saudi Arabia and the sale of all these weapons. But when Biden came into office, he actually sold more weapons to the Saudis, and they continue that practice up to today. So if you look at the history of West Asia in the last 40 years, you see Western governments, especially the United States, engaging in wars directly by occupying countries like Iraq, or by selling billions of dollars worth of weapons that is fueling the wars in this part of the world, and by supporting terrorist organizations all at the same time. And this is the hypocrisy that we have witnessed up to today. Iran, as you know, has been fighting ISIS. If it wasn't for Iran, ISIS would be taking over Damascus and Baghdad. Iran has been trying to create a regional security arrangements where powers like the United States don't interfere in the internal affairs of countries in this part of the world. And Iran is engaging in support of the Palestinian cause to remove the Zionist regime from committing this type of atrocities and apartheid that they practice.
Mohsen Abbas, the NDAA signed into law last week accuses Iran of lack of transparency with the IAEA and vows to combat what it describes as Iran's aggression. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said it was in fact the U.S. that violated international law by pulling out of the 2015 nuclear deal. So I think it's safe to say the JCPOA would not be dangling by a thread right now had Washington stood by its international obligations.
Well, the fact is that the, it's on record. The Americans withdrew unilaterally. That goes against any, you know, international, you know, norms or rules, if you like. But then the Americans consider themselves above any international rules or laws, and they violate treaties as and when they desire. They did it with the Paris Climate Agreement. They've done it with the Trans-Pacific Agreement. They did it with the JCPOA. So they have a track record of basically being untrustworthy. They anything they sign isn't worth the paper it's written on. The reality is that even if the JCPOA was signed by Biden, there'd be no guarantee that the Americans would stick to that, given another president would come in and tear it up overnight. So, of course, this cat and mouse game that's gone on with the JCPOA has really been ultimately an exercise in futility, to be fair, because not only the Americans haven't desired any reduction of the sanctions on Iran, nor have they desired any real peace with Iran, nor have they desired to be fair and balanced or just in that Middle East region. They favor the Israelis. They favor Israeli imperialism and expansionism. That's why the American bases are dotted around there. Other than that, of course, it's for the plunder of oil and gas and the other wealth that exists in that region, and of course to control their proxy dummy governments that they run in that region. So There's been no goodwill. The transparency, if anything, doesn't exist from the American side. At every level, they have hypocrisy loaded. In terms of the JCPOA again, if they were really serious about nuclear weapons being reduced in that region, well, the first country they've got to go to is Israel to get them to sign the non-proliferation treaty, which they haven't even bothered to sign. And of course, they ought also not to be selling nuclear weapons information to Saudi Arabia. They've actually been touting to American companies the possibility of going to Saudi Arabia and giving nuclear knowledge to them as well. So it doesn't look to me like they really are very transparent about their policies around nuclear proliferation in that region. And targeting Iran is simply Iranophobia. It's simply their imperialism and their sort of bullying of the only sovereign nation in that region, as far as I can see. I really honestly see only Syria and Iran as genuinely being sovereign. Virtually every other nation in that West Asian region is either a proxy, a puppet, or controlled by Americans and Israelis in one shape or form.
Professor Izzetti, we're talking about lack of transparency. It's the Israelis who are known basically as the sole possessor of nuclear weapons in the West Asia region. They enjoy unconditional support from the U.S. They're not signatories to the NPT. They do not cooperate with the IAEA and are believed to have a clandestine atomic weapons program. Just recently, of course, in an address to Parliament, Benjamin Netanyahu accused Iran of seeking to develop a nuclear bomb, an allegation that Tehran has repeatedly denied. How dangerous is this lack of transparency from the Israelis, which is never mentioned by the U.S. and its allies? How much of a serious threat does that pose to regional peace and stability?
Israel is a war state. They attack their neighbors. They attack people who live in Palestine. They kill a lot of people, imprison a lot of people, torture a lot of people. They're an apartheid state. They engage in a lot of illegal activities. One is the nuclear weapons that they are producing. We don't know how many because of lack of transparency. The estimates are 50, 60, 100, sometimes people say 200, 300, we don't know. They engage in terrorism all around the world, especially when it comes to countries like Iran. They have killed a number of Iranian scientists. They have killed other people in Iran. They are an entity that engages in criminal activities on daily basis with the full support, as you said, of the United States and almost all European countries. This is the fact that a lot of people in Iran see. So when the Americans talk about human rights, so when they talk about their concern about stability in this part of the world, people who are paying attention, and almost everybody is, they realize that they are exercising hypocrisy by supporting Israel. And this is actually what is causing Iran to be able to resist, because the enemy is so violent. The enemy is so outrageous in their actions. Very few people will disagree with Iran when it comes to defending Iran from this type of behavior. Ordinary people, I'm not talking about government officials. Although Israelis are causing difficulties for Iran, they have been doing it for the last 40 some years. The way they engage in their foreign policy and domestic policy actually makes them an easy target for Iran, because no one in their right mind would support an apartheid state that is engaging in wars on a daily basis. And you have a lot of people all around the world that are supporting the Palestinian cause, and they look at Iran and they see that Iran is actually holding the flag in support of the Palestinian cause. Iran is the only state in practice that is supporting Palestinians to defend themselves. And that is why they're upset with Iran, and so be it. You know, when it comes to supporting Palestine and Palestinian rights, Iran has been, in the last 40 years, the main supporter, and Iran will continue to do so.
Said Mohsen Abbas, on the issue of Israeli nuclear weapons, the Iranian foreign ministry spokesman says that this is an outstanding example of hypocrisy, dual standards, and discriminatory policies of various U.S. administrations. I want to get your thoughts on those comments, and if you may add, how is this overall hypocrisy ignored and overlooked?
Well, Israel has an exceptionalism which is kind of hardwired into international institutions, whether it's the International Criminal Courts or whether it's you want to go to the UN or whether you want to go to any of the other IAEA institutions or the WHO, you name it. All of these institutions, you have to remember internationally, they're purse strings rely on the Americans and private corporate big business. So they won't go beyond a certain level. And of course, given that Israel has carte blanche from America to do as it likes in the Middle East, it essentially means that all of these institutions will one way or another act hypocritically. And of course, Israel gets away with murder. Literally, it gets away with bombing Syria on a virtually daily basis, you know, violating its sovereignty with its aircraft on a regular basis. It's got away with occupying the Golan Heights, for instance, a territory which doesn't belong to it. It, of course, gets away with the murder and torture and abuse of Palestinians on a daily basis. It can provoke and stoke up wars, color revolutions, as it likes, again, with no accountability, all because the Americans and the Zionist lobby in America, including the Christian Zionists as well, give Israel a real support, a real strength. And if anybody goes against that, any nation, any institution, they know full well that the wrath of the American dollar will be brought down upon them, sanctions will be imposed, and they will be given maybe even, you know, color revolutions and regime change operations in their own lands. You only need to look at the likes of Venezuela and Peru even today to see that the Americans don't allow anybody really to squeak if they come out of their hegemonic control. Even Russia hasn't been spared, quite obviously. What's going on in Ukraine is a clearly provoked war by NATO, by the Americans, in order to bring Russia to heel as well. So a nation like Russia, which is self-resourced, which is self-sufficient,